Okay. In his Prolegomena to Any Future Metaphysics, Immanuel Kant distinguishes between, at the moment, because yes, I'm using, between limit, Schranke, and boundary, Grenze. Limits, Kant writes, are mere, whenever I do like that, it means it's a quotation mark. So, it's a citation. So limits, Kant writes, are mere negations which affect a quantity so far as it is not absolutely complete. While boundaries always presuppose a space existing outside of a certain definite place and enclosing it. For instance, and these are the examples that Kant gives, mathematics and natural scientific knowledge is limited in that it is never complete. For this kind of knowledge is confined to experience, and experience, which contains all that belongs to the sensible world, does not bound itself. It only proceeds from the conditioned to some other equally conditioned thing, without determining its boundary. Simply put, given that the object of mathematical or scientific knowledge is the empirical world, accessible to the senses, knowledge about this world can never be completed, since one can always discover new things regarding this world. For as Kant would put it, there is an indefinite progress in the series of experience, because of which further knowledge about experience is always possible. In other words, to say that limit is a concept that pertains to mathematics and sciences means that these fields are unlimited and hence at any given moment incomplete. By contrast, the knowledge of metaphysics, not mathematics and sciences, but metaphysics, is confined by the boundary between the knowable and the unknowable. In fact, it is part of the tasks of reason, the faculty that performs metaphysics, to think and define the boundary between what can and what cannot be known. Cardinal in Kant's transcendental critique of pure reason is the boundary between experience or appearance and the thing in itself. The result of the whole critique, Kant writes, is that reason leads us to the reference to something which is not itself an object of experience, but must be the highest ground of all experience, the thing in itself. However, Kant continues, reason does not teach us anything concerning the thing in itself, since the latter belongs to the unknowable side of the boundary that encloses the knowable. In short, while the realm of the limit is always unlimited and incomplete, the realm of the boundary is always confined and enclosed by its other. All this is true within the Kantian paradigm of enlightenment. Now, the implication of the title of my talk is that there is something, the gaze, that jars Kant's neat distinction between limits and boundaries. Assuming the arrogance of imputing thoughts to Kant, I would venture that if he were to read this title, he would understand that the gaze, whatever this may be, is something that posits a limit to boundary, so that the boundary opens up, and the space demarcated by it becomes open, unlimited, and incomplete, in such a way that the indefinite progress in the series of experience that was possible only within that space somehow begins to flow out of this space and inundates what used to be its other external space. It would look something like this. First you have this, a closed dam. Then comes the gaze, and that's what happens. And given the setup of his scheme, Kant would be right to declare that this is absurd. For how, for instance, could the progress in the series of experience, however far it may go, ever access that which is not experience, the thing in itself? This is why in making the claim that the gaze posits a limit to boundary, I refer to another conception of the limit. My limit, again, rathers whatever it affects unlimited and incomplete, but not because of some indefinite progress in the series of experience that could presumably transgress the boundary of experiences, delineated space, like water overflowing its dam, but because any appearance and experience in that space becomes possible only under a gaze that itself emanates as much from the internal bounded space as from the external space of the other. The gaze from which we experience the world is never just our gaze. It comes from here and from elsewhere. And although there is substantial theoretical work I could draw on in order to elaborate on this conception of the limit qua gaze, ranging from Jean-Paul Sartre's and Jacques Lacan's accounts of the gaze to Gilles Deleuze's Out of Field in his two cinema books, I will spare you all this and turn instead to Godard and Mieville's film, a film that, among other things, presents another audiovisual treatise on the gaze. So here we are. We're here. Here and elsewhere. Ici et ailleurs. And in Jean-Luc Godard and Anne-Marie Mieville and Jean-Pierre Gorin's film, Ici et ailleurs, evokes its two contrary semantic functions, identity and difference, in ways that challenge convenient resolutions between the two and the one, whether of the binary or the dialectical type. Nevertheless, the prodigious information apparatus monitoring the previewing process of the film, which was released in 1976, favorites difference. What you're about to see, we are told, is a French film by the members of the Giga Vertov avant-garde group, Godard, Mieville and Gorin, on the Palestinian Revolution of 1970. Thus, informercially, a double boundary is set up between the here of France, Europe, the West, as opposed to the elsewhere of Palestine, the Arab world, Islam, and the here of an institutionalized and by all standards quite peaceful artistic revolution, the avant-garde, as opposed to the elsewhere of a violent armed ethnic revolution. In short, the film is framed in terms of rich geopolitical and cultural boundaries. But then the actual film starts. Volume. Dimitri, do you know how to adjust the volume? You can barely hear this. So we are granted a split second to read the inscription Mon, ton, son, image. The son, image, flashing. Generally speaking, what I have read is the words that are flashing on the screen. So we are granted a split second to read this inscription before Godard's familiar voice hesitantly yet decisively begins to speak, as throughout the film, off-screen. Now let's go back to... Thank you. So Godard's film begins to speak as throughout the film off-screen and says, in 1970 this film was called Victory. In 1974, this film is called Here and Elsewhere. As far as the visual aspect of the film is concerned, this first image is equally invested in, on the one hand, soberly recording the difference between the first and second persons of the possessive pronoun, mon ton, my, your, while on the other hand, fervently flashing the identity of the male and female genders in the third person of the possessive pronoun. Son, for both his and her. This pronoun is as important as the noun, image. Not only because we're dealing with a film, but because this film was produced in Godard and Mieville's Son Image, Sound Image, workshop in Paris during the period of their film production known as precisely Son Image. Incidentally, sound as a character in the film, plays the role of ideology, as you probably noticed if you have seen the film. We'll come back to that. Given that we simultaneously also hear Godard's own voice, the mon, my, appears to refer to Godard himself. This is my, Godard's image. But the image simultaneously, acknowledges that it is also ton, your image, Jean-Pierre Goren, or more readily, Anne-Marie Mieville, as there is no trace of Goren's involvement throughout the film, but also your image, whoever you, spectator, happen to be. Indeed, in the next second, following the shot of the statue of the A, and carved out of styrofoam, gigantic as the screen, pure as white, majestic as a royalty on a blue pedestal, Mieville's voice will be introduced in a way that aligns her with the passive experience of spectatorship, as she will verbatim reiterate Godard's initial words as apishly as they echo in the spectator's ears, including his repetition of the end.
En 1970, ce film s'appelle Victoire. En 1974, il s'appelle Ici et Ailleurs. Et ailleurs. Et.
The will of the people. With this opening sequence, the film's narrative voices index from the outset the boundary between director and spectator, gendering in quite conventional manner the creative director as male and the passive spectator as female, only to neutralize this gender boundary through the visual identity of the third person possessive pronoun, which cautions, whether my or your image, no one can say whether this is his or her image. And while the boundary between genders is thus both affirmed and denied, both Godard's and Mieville's voices incontestably reaffirm another boundary, one between 1970 and 1974. But before we turn to these crucial years, let me add a few more remarks on these first seconds of the film. If you haven't seen the film here, I'm literally dealing with the first seconds of the film. Godard's opening voiceover has barely expired his last A, end, as the cut replaces his voice with Mieville's and the styrofoam A with the first real setting shot, a Palestinian woman, man, and machine gun in front of a landscape. A new cut brings us to another seemingly real setting, the living room of a low middle class French family in which the parental couple and their two little daughters are watching TV, surrounded by their Palestinian tatris, the embroidered tapestries and rugs that already in this scene begin to blur the presumed clear boundary between the here of France and the elsewhere of Palestine. The next cut, after the scene is just so, brings us back to another moment of what the spectator may associate with the Palestinian landscape, where a man explains at a small gathering of people that since the Palestinian land was not taken back by peaceful means, they have to follow the path of revolution, that is, of war and the gun. As many other Arabic voices throughout the film, his speech is quite faithfully translated into French through Mieville's off-screen voice. In other words, in less than the first minute of the film, Nieville's voice has been established as representing, one, the spectator, two, the real world, as opposed to the studio world of TV, video, and film alike, and three, the Palestinian people and will, presented as the revolution, whose language she alone, and not Godard, understands throughout the film. To approach now the shift occurring between 1970 and 1974, let us take a closer look at an early sequence in which it is explicitly thematized.
Un peu les banquiers et le gouvernement sur un certain nombre de revendications, mais on a vu que là, la force des travailleurs.
Partout, ça ne va pas. Nulle part, ça va. Ici, ça ne va pas. Je peux rien faire. Très vite, en France, tu ne sais pas quoi faire du film. Très vite, comme on dit, les contradictions et puis pas des toits avec.
Il y a une langue française et qui, cependant, que pour la première.
Je commence à le voir.
Les troupes, si
je commence à le voir comme moi.
C'est livré par les soviétiques et Moscou serait également.
Très vite, comme on dit. Contradiction éclate des toits avec.
En Israël.
Et je commence à le voir comme moi avec.
Tant, oh, deux.
Je commence à le voir comme moi avec.
Il descend pas.
Lorsque ceci, ceci, ceci. Ceci, ceci. Et devenu cela.
The sequence begins with a Palestinian training camp, thus confirming the spectatorial expectations by identifying the elsewhere with parts of the Arabic world. Reinforcing this expectation, the next cut brings us to yet another black screen on which the letters I, C, I slowly appear one after the other, forming the word C, here. While Godard says, and then we came back home. I came back, you came back. A further cut reveals a bright shot of the woman of the French family that since early in the film has been watching TV, while we can hear traffic noise along with Godard's continuing voice. From that, anyway, we haven't recovered yet. De ça d'ailleurs, on n'avions pas encore. A phrase which more literally says, from that, incidentally, besides, moreover, furthermore, we are not back yet. But the expression of this alternative adverb says literally, d'ailleurs, from elsewhere. So from that, from elsewhere, we are not back yet. At that moment, a cut brings us to the next black screen with the word unexpected in this homecoming context, a year elsewhere, flashing, while Godard continues. We ended up coming back. She, you, he, I came back here in France. The next scene formally replicates the shot of the French woman with the farmer of the family now in her place, while Godard's narrative proceeds. It didn't go well. And then days passed, months passed. The shot is interrupted by another black screen with the words le moi et le toi. The e flash. Our intuitive tendency to read this e and as asserting the difference, if not opposition, between the mis and the yous, is thwarted by dint of the fact that the film has by now contaminated the function of the end. the word repeatedly inserted between here and elsewhere. It has done so by visually and rhetorically labeling France, the here, elsewhere. Perhaps the means might turn out to be not that different from the use. In the next scene, the Frenchman and his little daughter are shown as we hear a mediatized male voice, likely coming from a radio, saying, "This one, I say, does not want to be a member of the Socialist Party." In the next black screen, the yous are above the mes, as it will be followed by an identical take of now the French woman and her other daughter, again listening to a mediatized female voice announcing, "This past week, in order to bring the government bankers to submit on several demands, we saw that the workers' strengths..." At this point, the voice becomes inaudible as Godard's voice takes over. It does not go well anywhere. Nowhere does it go well. Here it doesn't go well. "I can't do anything, je peux rien faire." Back in France, very soon you don't know what to make of the film. Tu sais pas quoi faire du film. Je et tu, I and you, have become exchangeable to our shared impotence. Not unlike the Frenchman and woman in their conspicuously identical shots, both accompanied by mediatized voices announcing the anxiety of a traveling left. Like the conjunction and, the film references boundaries only insofar as it also undermines them. Not only the boundary between his and her, son, but also between I and you, here and elsewhere, France and Palestine, we and they. All boundaries but one. From February to July 1970, we went elsewhere, to Palestine, and we shot a film, and then you, she, he, I, they came back to France, elsewhere. And no longer does any pronoun know what to make of this film. Is this elsewhere of the flashing intertitle attached to France the same elsewhere as the Palestinian? Well, it is first of all the Palestinian elsewhere that is no longer the same elsewhere with itself. It is not the elsewhere of 1970, February, July, but rather it is part of a homogenized, universalized anywhere or nowhere in which it doesn't go well. The here or elsewhere of France and the elsewhere of Palestine have given way to this zone of indiscernibility where it doesn't go well. Why? Perhaps because people do not want to be members of the Socialist Party and the workers' strength remains questionable, particularly since, as the film shows us, even their own wives do not sympathize with them. But all these reasons are subsidiary to the primal cause, which Godard, of course, does not hesitate to repeat. The frozen image of this literally and cinematographically mortified face, exposed for over 10 seconds, indexes the rupture that has occurred between Godard's and Jean-Pierre Gorin's 1970 spring and summer trip and Godard's and Nieville's first filming collaboration in 1974, the Black September of 1970. Whose shed blood stifled the Palestinian Revolution. The here of France and the elsewhere of Palestine have yielded to the lost here of a revolutionary era and to an alienating elsewhere, at once nowhere and anywhere, in which all, French, Palestinians, and revolutionaries throughout the world, find themselves after the failed revolution, be they literally or otherwise mortified. So far, it is only between these two sides, the irrevocably past here and the inescapably and ubiquitously present post-97 elsewhere, that a battery of cinematographic means is employed to divide through a gaping abyss. On a first level, it can therefore be argued that the film operates on the basis of a temporalization of the spatial categories of its title, here and elsewhere. And by temporal, I mean not some abstract category, but specific historical time. Through the explicit and contrasting discrepancy between the two titles of the film, the chasm opened up through the Black September of 1970 becomes a gulf between two historical zeitgeists, worldviews, and discourses, because of which not only the title, which parenthetically was not just Victoire, Victory, but Ziska la Victoire, Until the Victory. So not only the title, but also the initially short film has become obsolete and must be replaced by Ici et Ailleurs, Here and Elsewhere, this film. Wherein consists this drastic historical turning point, both specifically in the work of the Dziga-Vertov group and generally in European consciousness? Here I will borrow from Irmgard Emmelheim's succinct summary of the shift in question. So this is all from Emmelheim, which is, has interesting information. In 1970, the Information Service Bureau, FATAH, commissioned the Dziga-Vertov group, the collective formed by Godard and Jean-Pierre Goren, to make a film about the Palestinian Revolutionary Movement. Originally, the film was to be assembled from footage shot in refugee camps in Jordan, Palestinian refugee camps in Jordan, Lebanon and Syria, during a three-month stay in the spring of 1970. They planned to edit the film in Arabic with French subtitles. As militant filmmakers, Godard and Goren aimed not at making a political film, but at making a film politically, which, among other things, meant to step aside from traditional militant or political films founded upon the consideration of a viewer defined beforehand as either approving without reserve or disagreeing with the content of the film. And those of you who have seen the film, I believe you would agree that, if nothing else, the film fulfills this criterion. Before they finish the film, Godard and Goren plan to return to the Palestinian refugee and training camps to show the footage and discuss it with the Fedayeen. This was before the Black September massacre perpetrated by King Hussein's troops in the Palestinian camps in Jordan and the wave of terrorism that ensued. Because, as is explicitly stated in the film, almost all of the film's actors were killed, Godard and Goren could not finish the film as they had planned, and they decided to put the footage aside. It was not until 1973-74, when Godard met his new partner, Anne-Marie Mieville, that they decided to complete the film together as a kind of video essay, a self-reflexive degree zero of documentary. To move now from this specific film to the general shift in historical consciousness that took place in the 1970s in France and generally in the European left, we have to turn to the movement known as Tiers-Mondisme, or Third Worldism. Grouping several African and Asian nations as an alternative to both the capitalist NATO bloc, First World, and the Soviet Communist bloc, Second World, the Badung Conference in Indonesia introduced in 1955 the name Third World, a term coined by the French demographer Alfred Sauvy to describe an ignore-exploited world. The term was generally adopted in the 1960s in basically this sense. As a European ideological and political project and movement, Third Worldism became, in Emmelheim's words, a way to catalyze the issues of slavery, colonialism, socialism, and revolution, and it came to stand for a utopian outside from which the new would emerge, resolving the contradictions of the imperialist West. You may recall the sequence where you see two hands shuffling, four of Gerard de Villiers' SAS, Cold War paranoia spy novels, while Godard's voice repeats twice. Very soon, as one says, the contradictions explode, including you. I begin to see it. I begin to see it. The contradictions explode, me including. Third worldism was the promising remedy against the intractable contradictions of an imperialist and East Bloc phobic West. By 1968, and that's again Emil Hines, revolutionary tourism in the Third World was a widespread practice among the left, constituting a particular zone of aesthetico-political intervention elsewhere, as this film testifies. Beyond Godard, the examples include just about anybody you know from that era, from Pasolini, Adognoni, Rossellini, Varda, Pontecorvo, and René, to Duras, Barthes, Zondag, Zied, Kristeva, and so on. By contrast, as Emil Hines writes, the years 1973-74 in France marked the disavowal of the revolutionary subject and project and a wave of anti-totalitarianism giving way to a new humanism and, by many accounts, a new reactionary period in general, particularly in France. By 1978, Third Worldism had been dismissed as a sort of aberration of decadent socialism, while a new de-ideologized form of emancipation of the people of the Third World was called for. End of Emil Hines. So according to this new de-ideologized paradigm, Emil Hines continues, the 1960s revolutionary politics of emancipation had begun to struggle the former colonized people's rights and this now called for the imperative to safeguard their human rights. So the above narrative indicates that in the aftermath of the dramatic outcome of the Palestinian Revolution, a radical turn in the gaze of the European left occurred that revealed the hidden precondition of the revolutionary discourse of the 1960s and its third worldism. The latter, third worldism and the 60s revolutionary discourse, had been predicated on universalizing a cause so that the revolutionary from elsewhere could support specific political fantasies here. The present became past, by which I mean there was a moment in history where they, whereas they believed in that sense, oh no, that was past bullshit, whatever. Okay, so the present became past the moment third worldism was seen as founded on an imaginary relation with the other, in which the elsewhere was reduced to nothing more than a repository for Western utopian political dreams. In the face of this major, at once epistemological and political problem, which the film addresses almost avant la lettre, that is, at the very inception of the shift in political consciousness, because the discourse became conscious of it basically in 78, and we are still in 74. So, in the face of this major, at once epistemological and political problem, the shift proceeded to its mainstream second step, and by mainstream I mean it's not, this second step is not followed by Godard and Mieville and generally I guess the avant-garde. So and the logic of this mainstream second step can be formulated as follows. Well, if an ideological and political discourse is liable to imaginary projections with the other, then all a discourse needs in order to see reality clearly is to de-ideologize and depoliticize itself. Thus, a new ethical humanism, term from Emil Hines, emerged, in which revolutionary and political sympathy was replaced with, Emil Hines, pity and moral indignation, transforming them into political emotions within the discourse of pure actuality and emergency. We'll run into this assumption again. So between the first and the second steps of this shift, and as the actual third world disappointed their dreams, the third world's tourists were forced to come back and face the public exposure of what was now seen as their hidden, not laudable, narcissistic motivation. This is why their homecoming turned out to be a trip to elsewhere, the elsewhere of their dreams, the real stuff, narcissism, that the here of the manifest dream thought, the revolutionary from elsewhere, was hiding. But was narcissistic identification with the other really the real desire of the dream? When at the end of the film, Godard and more emphatically Mieville offer quite an explicit voice to what was repressed in the 1960s dream, we hear something else.
C'est vrai que même du silence, on n'a jamais écouté en silence. On a tout de suite voulu crier victoire, et en plus à leur place. Je ne sais pas, je ne sais pas, je ne sais pas, je ne sais
pas, je ne sais pas, faire la révolution à leur place, c'est peut-être qu'à cette époque, on n'avait pas vraiment envie de la faire là où on est. Plutôt que là où on n'est pas. Penses-tu qu'on a suffisamment de renseignements sur les positions israéliennes pour pouvoir mener à bien des missions contre lui? Non, on n'en a pas suffisamment. Est-ce que vous êtes capable de mener une opération suicide sur un point important de l'ennemi? Oui, nous sommes d'accord. Naturellement. En 1970, ce film s'appelait Victoire. En 1975, il s'appelle Ici et Ailleurs. Ici, une famille française qui regarde la télé. Ailleurs, des images de la révolution palestinienne. Ici, aujourd'hui, le bruit est l'image de ce bruit d'aujourd'hui. Ailleurs, d'abord hier, à l'étranger, ensuite demain. Ici, des images toutes simples. Des enfants regardent la télévision avant de faire leurs devoirs et après la soupe. Ailleurs, des images toutes simples. Des félalines critiquent la façon dont ils ont franchi la rivière sous les mitrailleuses israéliennes. Mais d'où vient-il que nous avons été incapables de voir et d'écouter ces images toutes simples et que nous avons, comme tout le monde, dit autre chose à propos d'elle, autre chose que ce qu'elle disait pourtant. Sans doute est-ce que nous ne savons ni voir ni entendre, ou alors que le son est trop fort et couvre la réalité. Apprendre à voir ici pour entendre ailleurs. Apprendre à s'entendre parler pour voir ce que font les autres. Les autres,
Godard's voice begins. We wanted to crawl victory right away, and furthermore at their place. Mieville continues. If we wanted to make the revolution for them, it's perhaps because at that time we didn't really want to make it where we are, but rather where we aren't. Godard and Mieville's interpretation of the dream goes much further than the analysis generally performed by the 1970s discourse. Both diagnoses agree that third worldism had been a dream concerning the first world itself. However, What remains evasive in the discourse's diagnosis, the film suggests, is the gaze for which the dream was faced. The widely acknowledged interpretation remains confined within the parameters of the manifest dream and the Hegelian dialectical logic of narcissistic projection. If we were dreaming of someone else's revolution, it is because in truth we ourselves wanted a revolution. Godard and Mieville, on the other hand, proceed to a conclusion beyond such mirrorings. We were dreaming of others' revolutions because we did not want our revolution. We did not want a revolution where we were. It is only under a gaze for which a revolution is undesirable here that one starts dreaming of revolutions somewhere else. The dream was staged for this gaze. Beyond the sheer projection between the here and the somewhere else, there is the radical alterity of the elsewhere of the gaze to which Godard and Mieville point, and because of which the reflection is deformed. The mirror reflection obfuscates that which is really reflected. The real desire is disguised to the point of non-recognition behind the fantasy. By pursuing their revolution, the Palestinians may have fulfilled, even in a devastating way for both parties, the fantasy of the European left, but not Europe's real desire. In spite of all globalization, the world is not a mirror of the West, however the latter may wish this to be the case. For Godard and Mieville's film, the Western elsewhere is neither the geopolitical somewhere else of a contested territory in the Arabic world, nor even the historical temporal then, a past that once produced and lost at some point in the 1960s, 70s in European consciousness. Rather, the elsewhere is always here and now. In the here and now, there is a rift between the here of what we imagine that we desire and the elsewhere of what we really desire. And this elsewhere, which is here and now, is precisely the gaze that, as I said from the beginning, is both inside, emanates from both inside and outside. Now, the gaze is one of Godard's central concepts, and as Jacques Aumont has put it, Godard's Son Image project is above all a new apprenticeship of the gaze. Hence the centrality of television and other media as one stand-in for the gaze in Godard's work, and particularly in the Son Image films, which are rife with references, and this applies to this film very well. So these films are rife with references to our hyper-mediatized society in order to show, as Michael Witte writes, that there exists a direct causative link between such imagery and the gauzes through which we as individuals perceive the world. But the representation of media in Godard's films should be taken as precisely that, one stand-in, and not as something that exhausts the filmic elaboration of the problematic of the gaze. To deal with the gaze always entails entering the realm of self-referentiality. Since, to refer to the well-known conundrum of philosophical consciousness, I cannot see myself seen. This is why the film treats itself as yet another media apparatus, no less complicit than the rest. Even as it offers us a view of the world distinctly aberrant from tri-televised representations, both in its content and formal organization, the commentary constantly reminds us that, not unlike the rest of media imagery, this representation is an arbitrary construction, hermetically controlled by the ideology, i.e. the desire and the gazes, that inspire it. Through this self-referentiality, the film endeavors to remind us of what is increasingly repressed when a discourse perceives itself as de-ideologized and claims that in the face of pure actuality and emergency, it is motivated by pity and moral indignation, this being assumed to be also non-ideological. It is the gaze of its own ideology that the film is struggling to reveal. But because of the self-referential nature of this task, the film can only obliquely point to that gaze, for no one and nothing can be the seer and the seen, the I and the me, elsewhere and here, at least not at the same time. Either a moving space or a time lag is required. And this is the riddle that Godard and Mieville are attempting to address in this film by seeking ways to articulate the split yet relation between the elsewhere and here, the invisible I that sees and the seen me that one mistakes for the I. Because this gaze cannot be shown or described, blindness and silence become instrumental in the film as means for pointing to it. In an approximately 2 minute long sequence, Mieville's voice introduces us to the five cardinal components of the revolution, whereby the message that the revolution offered a chance for women to partake actively in the public sphere is undercut by recurrently registering female participation on the side of men, replicating their moves and reciting their texts, not unlike Mieville's reciting of Godard's words. In one such sequence, an illiterate Palestinian woman is ventriloquizing a text dictated to her and composed by the Union of the Democratic Front. Mieville's voice intervenes to comment on the fact that the woman gets increasingly bored. In Mieville's words, she seems to wish she could go back to duties which don't ask her to speak, even if these duties have to do with repetition. Automatisms settle while repeating words in a certain order, words that she would have never said like that. But what would she have said? And how? In any case, the unions don't ask this question. Text, talk, talk, but never talk about silence. In the next sequence, Godard recapitulates formulaically the five stages of the revolution. SD1 is supposed to lead with inexorable necessity to the next, even as this necessity is parodied by Godard's emphatic caveat at other parts of the film that all these images and sounds have been organized by me, you, him, her, us, I organized. Yet as the film and history proceed, the fourth step in this purportedly necessary concatenation of revolutionary stages, as well as recording and editing decisions, is unexpectedly followed not by the fifth stage, victory, but by the Black September of 1970, represented in the film by the startling steel of a mutant blind corpse that replaces plain sound with extraordinary silence. The inertia of the corpse's static image registers both the collapse of the teleological sequence of historical events, as constructed under the gaze of the director, and the intrusion of historical time as such, that is, history without teleology or intentions. This image indexes the void gaze of a history without intentions or desires, which is to say, without living human beings, the history and gaze of the dead. The void gaze and silence of the dead is a necessary intermediary for the juxtaposition between the boundary, here versus somewhere else, and the relation, here, elsewhere. For only if history's gaze is void, can we fill it in with our imaginary ideological gazes so as to produce boundaries. This image is the reverse counterpart to the here, somewhere else boundary, which represents the problematic of spectatorial and political narcissism that the film addresses in its attempt to transgress it. To stress their point, Godard and Mieville adorn their corpse. Superimposed on the image is, first, the inscription Aman, September 1970, which inserts this image of death within a specific geopolitical historical context, and second, a whole text projected both backward and upside down, which will later appear under more readable conditions in two intertitles. In the subsequent shot of a refugee camp, men follow the instructions of a leading character whose shouting voice is gradually turned down by the filmmakers until the scene becomes silent. After some seconds, we see the following intertitle. Against the tendency programmed by the still and mute shot of the corpse, the choice of flashing words in these intertitles prevents any facile equation of death with silence. This is especially reinforced by the last inscription, a silence that becomes deadly because one prevents it from coming out alive. Who prevents it and how? The film actually responds quite explicitly, or apparently explicitly, the director. How? By being himself silent. In fact, next to the silence of the dead, the film foregrounds the director's silence, which, as we shall shortly see, it constructs as his most reproachable primal scene. I did not say the filmmakers, I said the director, which is a character in the film played by Godard, just like sound is a character that stands for ideology. Okay, so we have the director as opposed to the spectator, who is Mieville. So the film has from the outset, as I argued at the beginning, the film has from the outset painstakingly established the distribution of roles we have seen. Godard playing the invisible director, the all-seeing gaze in control of what is seen, and at least partly in control of the spectator, while Mieville is playing the spectator, as well as aspects of what is seen. Yet, the film does so only in order to bulldoze gradually the boundaries between these roles, as Mieville sporadically interrupts her prescribed role to take over the function of pointing to the elsewhere of the eye, the gaze that sees even the director. This occurs emphatically three times throughout the film. Here is the first time.
Le sang tellement fort qu'il a fini par noyer la voix qu'il voulait faire sortir de l'image. Dans les ruines de la ville de Karamé, une petite fille du Fatah récite un poème de Mahmoud Abou. Je résisterai.
D'abord du décor et de l'acteur de ce décor, c'est-à-dire du théâtre. Ce théâtre-là, d'où il vient de 89, de la Révolution française, et du plaisir qu'avaient les conventionnels de 89 à faire des grands gestes et à déclamer en public leurs revendications. Cette petite fille-là fait du théâtre pour la Révolution palestinienne, évidemment. Elle est innocente, mais peut-être cette forme de théâtre l'est moins.
Here the film takes up one of its recurrent themes, the reappropriation of past revolutions, staging it this time, quite self-referentially, on the register of theater. At once victim and innocent accomplice, and while gesticulating like Rouget de Lille singing La Marseillaise in any of the numerous French history book illustrations, The reciting girl becomes the centerpiece of the dramaturgy of the scene, through which the untranslated content of the poem, I Shall Resist, is rather as indifferent as predictable. This, by the way, is the first scene in which Mieville addresses the director directly. The second time is a scene in which Godard is heard explicitly directing a young pregnant woman who, so goes Godard's voice, is proud to give her son to the revolution. After a short while, Mieville snaps. In this take, this is not the most interesting, but that. Whereupon the screen turns black and we hear Godard's voice giving directions to the young woman. Mieville continues. First thing to say, it's always the one who is directed that is seen, never the one who is directing. The one that commands and gives orders is never seen. Yet, Mieville sees the director and breaks his silences to make us also see him. There is another thing that doesn't fit, she goes on. You have chosen for that take a young intellectual sympathizing the Palestinian cause who is not pregnant but accepts to play the part. Furthermore, she's young and beautiful. About that, you stay silent. But from secrets of this type to fascism, there is only one quick step. By saying this, Mieville exposes the director as a veritable impostor by betraying even the documentarist's trick and our corollary assumption. Parts of the previewing informations, the shots and location do not necessarily consist of actually documentary footage. In the progress of the film, the more the director speaks, the more she sees him, and the more silent he becomes. And the more silent he becomes, the more she learns to see here, so that she can understand what happens elsewhere. Finally, the third time concerns a scene in which the Fedayeen are once again shown discussing, and Godard asks Mieville to translate, which she does. So we learn that the Fedayeen are talking about the weaknesses of their strategy that expose them to their enemy, increasing the latter's chances of conferring a death blow on them. The director intervenes to note, not without some nostalgia. I do remember when we shot this. That was 3 months before the September slaughter. That was in June 1970. And in 3 months, the whole little group will be dead. What is really tragic is that they are here talking of their own death. But nobody said that. Whereupon Mieville retorts with no hesitation, no, because it was up to you to say it, and what is tragic is that you did not. He should have spoken up, Mieville argues. But how could the filmmaker have known at the moment of the actual shooting, 3 months before the fact, that these men were talking about their own imminent death? And since the director does speak when the scene is shown to the audience, what is he reproached for? Who is this he, and when and to whom should he have spoken up? In what here or elsewhere? And from what here or elsewhere is she, are we, critiquing him, her, us, for not speaking up? Mieville's last criticism epitomizes the exuberant ambitiousness of the film. The attempt to give voice and image to what by necessity could only be silence and darkness. By collapsing all other perceived elsewhere, the film wants to make histories elsewhere, the gazes of its makers, speak and be seen. It is striving to give voice and image to that which, at any given moment, history renders impossible to be said or seen, because it is the very gaze from which we see and hear whatever we do. But the film also suggests, even as we cannot know the gaze from which we see and hear now, sometimes we can at least have a glimpse of the gaze from which we saw and heard once at some past point in history. To do this is perhaps the sole way not to proceed to political action, but to act politically. Let us hope that our times are the time to do so. Thank you. And we should turn on the light.